I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Hello, and welcome to the Shakti Hour podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm your host, Melanie Moser, and we are returning now to the Shakti Sacred Music Series, conversations about sacred music and the feminine voice. Today, you are in for a treat. I got a chance to speak with manager and author Danny Goldberg, who once had the Rock and Rolls podcast on the Be Here Now Network. I highly recommend checking out his backlog of great chats. We sat down and got to listen to something from the Aretha Franklin record, Amazing Grace. And the timing of this was fantastic because it was just about a month before the theatrical release of the live movie showing the recording of this album. And so I got turned on to this particular medley that Danny played, and then we got to talk about it for like an hour before I even got to see the film. And I highly recommend, if you have time and it's in your town or when it becomes streaming, that you get out and watch this film and take it in as a spiritual teaching, and listening into this record itself, as Danny says later on, is actually like a transmission directly of the energy of Jesus. Danny is an incredibly accomplished music manager, has worked with so many great people. His new book, Serving the Servant, talks about his relationship with Kurt Cobain as he was managing Nirvana some 20-odd years ago. And this conversation is super deep and super cool, and I didn't know how to edit out this medley that Danny chose for us to listen to, so I kept the whole thing in. You can always go to ShaktiSacredMusic.com and hear the full tracks of everything in the series and get more information on the guests and the artists. But here I just let Danny introduce it and let it play, because there really is no good place to cut into Aretha's delivery of this beautiful medley and this directive to meditate on Jesus. I hope you are enjoying the Shakti Hour podcast. You can join us on patreon.com/ShaktiHour if you'd like to listen into the unedited conversations in the Shakti Sacred Music Series. You can also follow along on Twitter @ShaktiHour, and everything is on the BeHereNowNetwork.com Shakti Hour page. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. And please let us know what you'd like to hear on the Shakti Hour. We're putting together some new programming for the fall, and I'd love to hear from you. The Shakti Hour podcast @gmail.com. Now on to Danny Goldberg and Aretha Franklin, and thank you so much for listening.
What I have queued up is a medley from Aretha Franklin's album Amazing Grace. This was something she recorded. She's just about 30 years old. She'd become a superstar just in the previous three or four years, where she had the big hits like Respect and Natural Woman and so forth. and she returned to her roots. Her father had been a big preacher in Detroit, and a protege, or not a protege, contemporary of Martin Luther King, and a big supporter of Dr. King, Reverend C.L. Franklin, who's also and she did an all gospel concert in a church in Los Angeles, and it was recorded. And the album, which was called Amazing Grace, became, and I think to this day, is still the best-selling gospel album ever. Wow. And it was filmed, and the film stayed in a vault for decades for reasons that I don't totally understand. And then it was finally released in the last couple of months, right after her death. They sorted out the legal problems. And it's stunning. I don't know if it's on digital services yet, but it will be any minute. It was shown in little art theaters in the last few months. And a friend of mine got me a copy of it maybe 6 or 8 months ago, and I just became so mesmerized with the beauty and the spirit of it that I just watched it repeatedly. So this track is a medley of the gospel classic Take My Hand, Precious Lord, and Carole King's song You've Got a Friend.
Awesome. Let's hear it.
When you're down in trouble, you need some love and care. Ain't nothing.
Wow.
Wow. It kills me every time I hear it. I just tripped out listening to it again.
There's so much. How does it even sound that good?
Well, she got, again, she was at the peak of her commercial power, so there was no problem. She used the same engineers that made all the big Aretha Franklin hits. She had Tom Dowd and Arif Mardin and Jerry Wexler, the same people who produced Natural Woman and everything there, and they brought it, the sound truck, and did the mixing. She got her musicians, the great musicians that played with her, and some great chorus from an LA church. I forget what they were called. So it was done with tremendous care and attention on every level, and obviously her singing, she doesn't need any help with that. Just try to capture it.
It is so cool how surrendered and held in the space it is. Like it's instantly sacred from the feeling of the space of the sound to me, because I can feel that they're inside of this.
Well, she's certainly not the only R&B star who first sung in a church, but she did grow up in a church. Her father was this reverend. She was in the movie. You'll see there's a great gospel artist named Reverend James Cleveland, who was had a pure gospel artist who had worked with her from the time she was a teenager. They were friends. And he is kind of the musical director of this particular performance. So, you know, she emerged from that spiritual tradition. This was not something she was experimenting with. This was a return to how she was brought up. And right, at the same time, she was at the peak of her musical powers to execute it and express it. And to me, just as a listener, it's a way of tuning into Jesus. You know, it's just so hard to separate some of these names that are so incredibly famous, like Jesus, from, you know, the Catholic Church and evangelicals and all sorts of rules and political and cultural stresses that are, and to remember the actual essence of Jesus is difficult for me, but it's not difficult when I listen to her.
Right. Well, that's, I think that's what I'm getting at, is that it wasn't her on top, putting her talent on top of the church. It really felt like it was coming out of it.
Yeah, coming through her, for sure.
Coming coming out of that, and the support of the backing choir and even of the band when it's like the bass line that comes in is just crazy. It's just like a slapping on a table or something, but so perfect in its evolution, like, and in its build.
Yeah, the whole album's pretty spectacular. And again, anybody who can get access to the film, and I'm sure in this era of streaming, these things become pretty easy to get. It's a really wonderful, it's just concert. There's no other backstage documentary or interviews or anything. But it's my favorite concert film. And this is great for us rock and roll freaks. It's, you know, 99% of the audience is black. And then in the middle, it was recorded and filmed over the course of 2 days. They did two different performances and combined the highlights of them. And on the second day, there's the camera pans, and you see in the back Mick Jagger and Keith Richards there. Somebody must have, they knew people at the record company, and someone must have told them, you might want to check this out. It's just kind of a little vicarious glimpse at what that moment must have been like in LA. But the music is the main thing, and it's music has this way of breaking through other parts of the mind that connecting you with something special when it's at its best. You know, music can do a lot of other things, but when music does that, it's got a particular energy to it that much appreciated. You know, I think it's the same thing of kirtan or, all sorts of other spiritual music. But I definitely think she's in that league spiritually, to me.
Totally. And also the image of the two of them in the back of the church, though, actually is pertinent to my curiosity, in that, you know, maybe people would not associate the Stones with sacred music.
No, I don't. But you associate them with black music. There's no question. The Rolling Stones was an homage to R&B. I mean, the name Rolling Stones was taken from a Muddy Waters song called Rolling Stone. And all their first records, they were doing their versions of Marvin Gaye songs and Smokey Robinson songs and so on. And there's no question that their musical style is directly influenced by the blues and R&B. So I think they might, I don't know if they came for Jesus, but they got him. You know, I'm sure they were there initially, possibly for the music, because she's also, just in pure musical terms, the greatest singer of her generation, many of us feel, certainly of that idiom, of that genre. But nonetheless, they were there, and I bet even no matter what, I have no idea what the spiritual thoughts are of members of the Stones, but I can't imagine being there and not feeling something.
Well, of course, but I mean, she herself, Aretha herself, spoke of her voice as a gift from God.
Yeah.
I mean, she said that this is what this is, and this is what I'm supposed to
use
it for.
Yeah, no, she's a preacher's daughter, and didn't run away from it, you know, and and also was proud of her, you know, pop and secular music. But it's interesting, again, a lot of artists made that crossover. Ray Charles came out of the gospel world and then became a gigantic pop and R&B icon. Sam Cooke, same thing. The early Sam Cooke recordings of the Soul Stirrers, if you were asking for men or women, I would have had a hard time choosing between Sam Cooke's gospel and Aretha's. But Aretha, uniquely, after she became successful, revisited it. With full focus and attention, and created that record as well as some subsequent things. So
that's what's so honoring about it, is that it feels, I can feel that, and I like that you use the word revisited, because I can feel that it isn't a going back to redo or to replace it with something else. It's going back to like bring that power of the pop world basically into it.
Correct.
And to imbue it with that moment in time.
And it worked. It was extraordinarily successful. Long time ago, so it's easy to forget. But in the context of the early 1970s, it was a gigantic commercial success.
The record itself,
far greater than any other gospel music of that
era.
Well,
Elvis did that too, no?
Elvis did, and I like some of Elvis's gospel stuff, but not quite as much as I like Aretha's.
No. So what do you get when you say you feel you get a connection with Jesus through this? Like, what does that mean to you? What's that experience like?
Well, it's another doorway to the unnameable ocean of love, you know. My spiritual teacher was named Hilda Charlton, and she used to say, you know, whether water is in a glass or it's in a bottle, it's still water. And that all the true spiritual vehicles are vehicles of that one spirit. So growing up with the name Goldberg, I was attached to the idea we're a Jewish family. We're not a particularly religious family growing up, but it was still culturally Jewish. And I was a little negative about the whole Christianity thing. Especially because this elementary school I went to was mostly Catholic kids, and every once in a while there'd be some weird moment. And it took me until I really read Ram Dass and met Hilda and started meditating in my early 20s to reopen my mind to the idea that Jesus, as the old song goes, Jesus is just all right. And it was really listening to a sermon once on the radio of Dr. King. He did this Mother's Day sermon where it was so filled with love. It was so much the same thing I was getting out of listening to Ram Dass speak or meditating or early psychedelic experience. It was the same truth that it allowed me to open my mind to Jesus. And then there was this statue on Sunset Boulevard somewhere of Jesus with the Sacred Heart. And that's my favorite image of him. Nothing against other images, but it's positive. It's the Sacred Heart. It's love. It's not associated with the crucifixion or anything. And, it's just to me another way of connecting with God. Any way that one can connect with it is good. So you try to meditate, try to read about things, try to think positive. But music can sometimes get you there. And, sometimes I want to go where Aretha went. You know, I don't know what else to say, you know.
Right. So it's almost like a transmission of her own spirituality, her own relationship.
I think it's a transmission of Jesus's energy through different vehicles, and that she had one of the greatest talents of her generation and a commitment to maximize it, and honored that part of herself that loved Jesus. Again, we're all complicated people, and I'm not saying she was a dictionary definition of a saint, but I think in those moments when she's doing that, she is like a saint.
And do you that's really cool. Do you think that is if she's sainted, given that sainthood through the actual context? Or I have this question of, does the song have to be about Jesus to connect you with Jesus? Is kind of where I'm like.
Well, I don't know. Probably not. I mean, but but it depends who you are and what your own background is. For me, because I didn't grow up going to church or anything like that, it has a particular effect. It's a mystery, you know, how music affects people. And it's also a mystery what the relationship is between the artist and the spirit, because we know that there are artists who can be vehicles for extraordinarily elevating art who in their day-to-day life are quite troubled in one way or another, to just, you know, in varying degrees. So it's a little different from, say, a yogi or a fully realized, you know, saint of another line, what great artists do in the world. And I wouldn't limit it to gospel music. Certainly, I feel that way about certain classical music, certain Eastern music, and I feel that way about some of Bob Dylan's songs too, you know, and Leonard Cohen's songs and other artists that, to me, sometimes tune into a higher energy, and through their talent, they're able to connect with an audience who otherwise wouldn't necessarily be tuned into that. You know, it enters into the earth realm in a way that conventional spirituality doesn't. So I don't understand how it all works. I just like it.
Right. And that's part of the gift of the musical experience, yeah. Right? It's like you don't have to, I mean, we could sit and, you know, pick apart the arrangements of that song, which are amazing. The way that it's mixed is so beautiful, and it sets it up to have that experience. I feel like the way that the sound and the instruments, including the voices, are held in the space actually do a lot of the work to give me, the listener, the space to be there with them, you know?
Well, you know, she went through an interesting journey as an artist. I mean, she was a great singer at a very, very young age. And again, her father was well connected in Detroit. So she got a record deal quite early. She was probably 19 or 20 or whatever. And the first several albums she made on Columbia Records were just good records. They weren't amazing, though. And then she switched to Atlantic, and there was a guy there who's one of my mentors in the music business, so I like to acknowledge him. His name, Jerry Wexler, who had this idea to give her a musical context where she could be more free to improvise and wasn't limited by the exact structure of a song or the exact structure of the tracks. And that paradigm shift in the way she was being recorded resulted in everything she's famous for. So the first several Aretha albums, they're perfectly good records, but that's not why we remember her. We remember her for Natural Woman, Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You, Respect, and, you know, 15 other, you know, if you look at that greatest hits album, Aretha Gold, you know, every one of those songs was after that transition. And then a year or two after those hits, once she had found herself as a singer and found a group of people who created the context for her to really reach a level of artistic excellence that she hadn't when she was first in the confines of conventional arrangements, she decides to make this gospel record. So it was a fusing of her original spiritual roots and religious beliefs with the optimum creative environment for her, which took her a few years to find. Her first few records are not as memorable as what she did after that.
Right. And so that improvisational element, it seems to come up and in this conversations that I've been having around the idea of sacred music, it seems to be kind of an essential part of sacred music is this improvisational element, or I like how you said she had the freedom to, there was some freedom to be with spirit, really.
Well, look, there's no, first of all, I'm not a musician or a singer, so I'm trying to describe things that I actually have not experienced and won't, because I wasn't born with those particular talents, but I've admired musicians and singers and worked with them for all these years, and there's definitely a distinction between a great performance, like you might see, say, on Broadway being the epitome, or an opera, that it can be artistically excellent, but it's a craft. And then there are artists who are really in the moment when they're singing in a more intimate, present level. Now, it's not limited to gospel. I mean, there are other artists that I feel did that. I mean, I feel, you know, in terms of the people I've worked with in the past, I felt Kurt Cobain did that every time I saw him sing. And he wasn't singing, quote unquote, spiritual music, but there was an intimacy and a presence and an in-the-momentness that's different from sort of a memorized craftsman-like execution. And I think particularly if you're trying to get into a space of thinking about God, that it's better if the person gets their personality out of the way and lets it come through them, you know.
But you do have you do have spiritual practice. You know what that means to attempt to be in that state, to surrender the mind to the heart or to set the ego aside, however you want to.
Yeah, but a lot of great singers don't have what we would consider a conventional spiritual practice. They came in with that ability to let the spirit move through them. They're like born with it, the way a great athlete is born with the ability to jump higher or something like that. They still need to work on it and do the exercises to maximize it, but they're not necessarily, you know, meditators. They were born with this gift, and if they honor it, then the spirit can come through.
Right, but of course, right. But what is your personal experience of having that? Like, not through singing or through, but, you know, in your day-to-day life, have you had?
Oh, my day-to-day life, I'm a pretty textbook hippie, experience, had vague questions as a kid, but it was subordinate to my day-to-day anxiety and aspirations. And then took psychedelics and everything turned into light. And I liked that. And then realized, like as zillions of other people did, including Ram Dass, that there was a limit to what that could do for you. And did read, you know, was heavily influenced by Be Here Now. I was heavily influenced by the idea that George Harrison of the Beatles was somehow connecting at the peak of his being one of the most famous people in the world, was connecting with Hindu traditions. And, you know, over the years, just tried to tune in more and more to it. Through Ram Dass, I met a spiritual teacher named Hilda Charlton, who passed away in the late 80s, but who from the early 70s till while she was on earth was very much somebody that I looked to for guidance. And she was somebody like Ram Dass and others who believed that there are many, many paths to the same goal, and that what matters is the goal, not what you call it. Over time, try to pray. When I was younger, I had a very hard time meditating, but I always used to say it's easier to pray than to meditate. And so I was always a prayer. Once I started praying, I never stopped. And then last 7 or 8 years, I've really been able to get into the habit of meditating every morning. And it's definitely a good thing. I recommend it if you can do it. And if you can't do it, prayer is a good second choice. Because it's just connecting with something outside of your own mind, out of your own, you know, confines of minute-to-minute perceptions of reality.
Is music a prayer? Like, do you think that, like, putting on this record in the morning could be, and listening with it could be, like, a prayer? Or?
Well, I don't know. Music is kind of in a category of its own. And I would put it in the same category as sort of being in nature, like climbing a mountain, or just exposing yourself to energy that transcends the mind and that implies the grandeur of the universe in some way, whether it's looking at a leaf or hearing great music. It's not exactly praying because you're on the receiving end. It's not as affirmative a decision as praying, but it can certainly put you in the right frame of mind. And I don't think it's any accident that a lot of churches will have a choir and then a sermon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at Hilda's meetings or at Ram Dass's, there would be music and then a sermon. That there's something about music that can bridge between the mind and the heart in a way that's, for many of us, quite useful if it's the right music. I mean, music has a lot of other functions with, like, you can dance to it and all sorts of other things that have nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And those are very valid forms of music. But the kind that we're talking about, I think is a bridge. I don't think it's exactly the same as praying or meditating, but it facilitates both of those things.
Yeah. It's been 20 minutes since we've listened to the piece, and I can still feel it. Her, like, her voice resonating in my own heart. Like, it created a space in me just from listening to it.
Well, here. There's a thing about great singers. It's not only the words. It is the voice itself that has an amazing power to it. And there are only a handful of people in every generation that have that. I just watched a documentary, I forget what service it's on, about Maria Callas. And I don't particularly have an ear for opera. I was just always curious about Maria Callas. And I could sense, without being an aficionado at all, how unique her voice was. And there are people, in addition to the lyrics, there's so many layers to it, but her voice on anything, you know, just cuts through. It's why when she passed away recently, there was such an outpouring of appreciation. It wasn't mourning as much as appreciation for what she gave us. You know, when people pass away, there's all different kind of reactions the society has. And I noticed with her, there was a joyousness to the fact, well, my God, at least we had her. She was here on Earth, you know, and she gave us this legacy. She's one of the great ones, you know. There are certainly many, many other great artists in every generation, but she's one of them. And for my lifetime, you know, certainly in the top, right up there with John Lennon, Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, you know, in terms of the iconic geniuses that inspired my generation.
Yeah. Well, and you said the voice. You mentioned Kurt's voice or Kurt's performance having that similar capacity, but the content is different. So I'm curious about that personally in music. Like, you can go to see a performance and you can get this transmission. It could be a transmission of pain, even, or transmutation of pain, but because the performer and the voice is so present, it doesn't leave you with that residual.
Well, there are a lot of different functions, like we're saying, that music plays. Yeah. And I think, for example, I think people who love the Grateful Dead got a sense of community that was transcendent out of those performances that was not necessarily connected to conventional or even unconventional spirituality, but it was at a higher level than just regular pop music. I think one of the other jobs that music can do, particularly during adolescence, is make people feel less isolated and less alone. And that's a good thing. You know, it's not exactly the same as tuning into Jesus, but it's a very positive, loving, healing thing that's makes life better. And I think that was Kurt's lane, is that he had this empathy for the underdog, for the forgotten, for lonely people, for people that felt like outcasts. And there was something about the way he expressed himself that made his fans feel recognized and less isolated and less alone, partially by just hearing the music and partially by the recognition of their connection to other people that were also, you know, liking the music. And that's a more common role that sort of pop music at its best can play.
Right. Which isn't necessarily sacred or spiritual, but creating the space for that, would you say? Or
it creates a space for it, because it's really hard to be open to spirituality if you're sort of hating yourself or miserable. Sometimes it can lead you to open up to want that, but, you know, I think that who's to say what's sacred? I mean, on one level, everything is sacred. Every molecule of every, you know, as Dylan wrote, every grain of sand, you know. On another level, there is a hierarchy of communication. And, you know.
So how do you determine what you go to your record cabinet to pull and put out? Like,
well, first, obviously, it's long gone since there's a cabinet. It's all on.
I know, it's all. A cabinet.
It's a blessing and a curse, but more of a blessing, I think, that you know, there are these services like Spotify or Apple or these others where sort of 99% of the music you'd want to hear is available. You know, I'm older. You know, I'm in my late 60s, and I'm tend mostly to listen to older music that just try to make me feel good, you know. And I'll go back a lot to some of the blues, Mississippi John Hurt. I'll listen to Aretha. I'll listen to Dylan a lot. Or I also, on a separate part of my brain, probably the number one artist that I listen to on Spotify is certainly Krishna Das, because I just, there's something about his voice that touches me in a way different. There's a lot of people that sing kirtan. I honor them. But if there's something about his particular voice that puts me in the right, you know, in a good frame of mind. So I have an eclectic thing. And then I have the complicating factor of making my living in the music business for the last almost 50 years, which is means that on one level, I'm a little blocked about appreciating certain music because I commingle it with my disappointments and aspirations in the business. So it kind of ruins a certain kind of experience for music for me.
Yeah.
At the same time, it gives me a deeper connection to certain artists that I do work with. Like, I've managed this guy named Steve Earle for the last more than a decade. And, you know, I love his music, but I also associate his music with my relationship with him. I can't separate these things out. So I have a... I'm not a great connoisseur of new music. I admire people who are, but again, I'm my own life is such that it feels a little bit like work when I do that, and that's not the space I necessarily want to be in when I'm listening to music. So I'll tend to go to older things, but every once in a while something new touches me. But
There's something in all of those voices that I'm picking up on this theme. There's a bit of a surrender in the voice of all those different people, where there's a set that I think you said it like, you know, setting the ego out of the way. And there's all the things you mentioned have some sort of transmission.
I mean, there's different strokes for different folks, as the great Sly Stone wrote. I was just had breakfast with a very good friend of mine who's a music fanatic. He's not in the business, so he has a pure connection to music. And he loves listening to jazz. And a lot of people that I know, they're very, very smart, find an enormous amount of depth in jazz. And certainly John Coltrane, you know, clearly a spiritual being. And Ornette Coleman, who I knew personally, was one of the most cosmic people I ever met, but I rarely listened to his music because I never tuned my ear to appreciate it. Similarly, my son loves hip hop and gets and understands depth from it that I just don't have access to because I didn't tune my ear to that. And as classical music, which is obviously some of it is so elevated and deep, I only have a dilettante's connection with certain pieces of music, mostly ones that I heard when I was younger. You know, I came of age listening to Dylan, the Beatles, rock and roll, you know, major chords, guitars, poetic lyrics. That's the genre that is my preferred one, but I don't think it's better than other genres. It's just the language that I speak the best.
But Nirvana was a lot of dissonance, but presented.
Yeah, well, I thought it was beautiful dissonance. You know, yeah. I thought it was addressing the emotional space of its listeners in a way that was truth. And so it came across not manipulated, not calculated, that it had a truth to it, and it had an emotional power to it. And to me, I feel a lot of inspiration from it. But again, I'm prejudiced. I was in my early 40s when I worked with Nirvana, and if I hadn't worked with them, I might never have even gotten that familiar with their music. But experiencing it and experiencing the way audiences reacted to it, and the way to this day, 25 years after Kurt's death, people still want to talk to me about him, I understand his relationship with his audience in a way that I might not have given my age if I hadn't worked with them. But, you know, I think that, look, a lot of Dylan's lyrics, Leonard Cohen's lyrics, John Lennon's lyrics can be very dark. Jerry Garcia, too. But the darkness is in pursuit of truth. There's an article I read last week in the New Yorker, David Remnick wrote about Buddy Guy, the great blues man who's in his early 80s now. And he said, Buddy Guy says in it, the funny thing about the blues, he said, if you don't have them, you can't play the blues, but after you play them, you don't have the blues anymore. Right. And I think that's true, and I don't totally understand it. I mean, maybe words like catharsis are related to it.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's that phenomenon that Ram Dass would talk about of being able to witness something. All I know is it's true. There's something paradoxically joyous about the blues.
Right. Right.
I'm working now, and again, I'm biased by the people I work with. I'm working the last year or two with an R&B singer named Betty Levette, who's 72, and she claims to be an atheist, and I believe her that she believes that, but God, there's a spirit that comes through her as a performer that's deeply moving to me. Hmm. I'm not so sure about that idea of labeling something spiritual and other things not spiritual. To me, the key word is love, and if something opens your heart to love, to me, that's spiritual.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's great. If something opens your heart to love, that's spiritual. Tell me, what was the musical experience that drew you into the music business?
Well, when I was a teenager, I was one of those people when I was 13, 14, feeling very alone and disconnected. And I remember when I was 14, I think, I was at some Quaker summer workshop thing my parents sent me to that ended up being a great idea. I got a lot out of it. It was during the Vietnam War, and learning about pacifism and kind of a loving element of the anti-war movement really was a great thing. But there was a guy there that sang a song I'd never heard before called I Ain't a Marchin' Anymore. And it turns out that the artist who wrote it and originally sung it was Phil Oakes. So I went home and got Phil Oakes' record, and those were political songs. There was an album called All the News That's Fit to Sing, and it was just somehow expressing in songs what I was feeling. And that led me into some other songwriters that to me were meaningful. And then the first time I smoked dope, I remember exactly the records we listened to was Rubber Soul by the Beatles, Out of Our Heads by the Rolling Stones, and Daydream by the Lovin' Spoonful.
How much later was that than the Quaker
Camp? That was
maybe
a couple of years later. Maybe okay. I'm 16. So by that time, now I'm just in love with the rock and roll of that time, and felt that was speaking for me more than any novels or theater or movie or anything like that. And just Hendrix and some of the other artists that emerged, and you know what one's record collection was a way of, you'd go to someone's house and see what records they were listening to, and you felt like you knew them. Then I just stumbled into the music business when I was 18 because I needed a job, and I didn't even know there was a music business. I just knew I needed a job, and I got a clerical job at Billboard magazine, and it turned out that there was this business around the music that I loved, which was a great, exciting thing to me because I knew I had no musical talent. I couldn't possibly be a songwriter, a musician, or a singer. I just tried to play instruments. I just couldn't do it. But I could be a fan, and then there were these people that got to go to concerts for free and then write their opinions about them and get paid for it. And I thought, how do I get that job? So, I over time wormed my way in, and it's been a good run, and, you know, it's not worth going into the whole story. But the music that originally inspired me was definitely, the same things that inspired
but
a lot of people.
But you've had these
in
relationships
the 60s.
With different artists, so you have had this intimate, you have an intimate relationship with different artists, which takes you into the music and the experience of it in a different way.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. As we sit here, in 2 weeks, Stevie Nicks is going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I was started a label in the early 80s with a good friend of mine named Paul Fishkin, and we knew Stevie and recorded her for a solo album. So she's like invited us to come and sit with her at this thing. So that's like kind of mind blowing to me that you know, it's 37 years later. That was 1980. That's almost 40 years later. The sense of camaraderie that some of us had who believed that her is a solo artist. It sounds now ridiculous. Why wouldn't you? But she was in this band, and the band, it was not clear initially which were the members of the band that were the most talented.
Is that the picture of the moment?
Oh, me and Stevie?
Yeah.
Well, the one behind you of me and Kurt is really the one of the moment.
All right.
I appreciate, I am corny and old school enough to have a few pictures of myself with a few people that meant something to me in the office. It's part of marketing when someone comes in. See, I really knew famous people. Right. I'm not just bullshitting.
Right.
And part of it is I like looking at them because it kind of tunes me into certain moments that mean something to me. It's a little it's a little corny and a little egotistical, but I have not...
it's
totally
on the wall
the
in a frame. That makes it so much cooler. You and Stevie, you and Kurt, you and Ginsburg.
Yeah.
And who painted your Krishna?
That's Ione Skye did that. Mm-hmm. She is married to one of my other clients, Ben Lee, mm-hmm. who is, talk about an artist who's also a spiritual being. He's a remarkable artist based in Los Angeles, originally Australian. And for the last decade or so, he's been married to Ione Skye, who's an actress, and she's also a painter. And she had an exhibit of her paintings a few years ago, and I just fell in love with that Krishna and bought it, you know.
That's great. And then we've got Woodstock right above you.
Yeah, that's a, you know, I was at Woodstock as a reviewer. I was 19, and Billboard sent me as the guy to review it. And so it's always had a totemic symbol for me in my head. And that photo is, you know, was given to me for many birthdays ago by someone. And it was, it's a Swami Satchidananda, who was one of the people that really brought yoga to a lot of Westerners in the late 60s. And I didn't know him. I sort of went to a few of his lectures and looked him in his eyes once. I wasn't like a member of any organization he had, but I respected him a lot. And he gave like a blessing at the beginning of Woodstock. And that was a moment in rock and roll and pop music that was kind of unique, where they would think that for this biggest rock festival of the world, they should have a yogi come out and do a blessing at the beginning of it. So I like that picture. It's sort of him from behind, and then you see them several hundred thousand people out in the audience. And, you know, that particular version of Woodstock did turn out well for most of us that were there. So I like thinking about that as an aspiration of what rock and roll at its best can do.
And how does that fit into your understanding of karma?
You know, I don't know that I have any great understanding of karma. You know, I just want to try to... get into a place of remembering God as much as I can, and opening, you know, being in a space of love as much as I can, and not being a prisoner of my paranoia or easily hurt feelings or anxieties. You know, how karma works. There's smarter people than me about that. I just don't know. I just try to do the best I can from minute to minute. I'm not even sure how much of this is really me doing anything, or I, you know, a lot of times it feels more like being on one of those rides at Disneyland where you're on a moving, you know, carpet, and it's somebody's already written the script. I'm not sure how much of the script I'm contributing to, but to the extent I can
of these, you know, pretty iconic figures throughout your life and stumbling into a job at Billboard at 18.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Those things are, you know, that's pretty undeniable.
Yeah, I mean,
flow of life that wasn't a, you weren't ambitiously
at that time. I just wanted to be able to have enough money that I could get my own apartment and then have to live with my parents. There's been many, many times when, there's a story I've told on other podcasts on Be Here Now, but not on yours. And it either will or won't be of any use to you. But, you know, when I was 22, I had spent several years as kind of a rock critic and sometimes a PR consultant. I was kind of making a living doing this. The business was so exploding at that time. And then it cooled off a little bit, and my own relevance cooled off. And I found myself unemployed for several months, and I was running out of money. And I think I had one more month's worth of rent left, and was trying to think, is there anything I could sell? And I was somehow convinced myself that if I ever had to ask my parents for money at that time in my life, I might as well just die. I just felt that would be a... I was very attached to the idea of not doing that, because it would have been such an admission of failure that I hadn't gone to college and all this sort of thing. And I couldn't, I just was really freaking out. I called everybody I knew and I couldn't get a job. And I looked in the Village Voice ads and Times and there was nothing happening. A couple of my friends did set up an interview or two for me, but nothing came through right away. And around this time, Ram Dass was in New York. And he used to stay sometimes at the apartment of a woman named Gloria Stavers, long ago passed away, but who was the editor of 16 magazine, an interesting character in the history of pop culture that's worthy of another conversation. Mm-hmm. So I had met him once before, and he had told me about, why don't you try the Zen Center? So I went to some Zen Center and sat there, and I just got very little out of it. My legs hurt, and I just didn't feel that inspired by the whole thing.
Ram Dass told you to go to
And it just wasn't working for me. So then I got to see him again. He was back in town, and I said, look, I know last time, you know, he sees zillions of people. There was no reason he would remember my particular thing. I said, look, I tried the Zen Center. I just didn't feel anything about it. I mean, I'll go more. And he just laughed. He says, I don't care if you go to the Zen Center or not. He said, maybe there's something else you would like. He says, there's this woman, Hilda Charlton, does these meditations on Thursday. Why don't you try that? Let me find out the address. And he calls someone and gives me the address. So I go down there, and it was in St. Luke's Church, which is subsequently burned down and been rebuilt, but it's on Hudson Street. And I go in, and there's like a couple of hundred people, all with weird beads and robes and chanting stuff. I didn't know what they were doing, and I felt quite out of place. But I kind of made myself, I said, look, I'm down here already. I made myself. So she started speaking, and at some point she said, you know, you've got to challenge God, kids. She always called all of her students kids. She said, you got to say, God, I don't care what you did in the Bible thousands of years ago. I need to know that you exist now and in my life. And you've got to say, Jehovah, Lord of the hosts, you said, try me and prove me. Well, I need you to answer this prayer in 24 hours. So I walked out. I didn't know anybody there onto the street. And I said, okay, God, Jehovah, Lord of hosts, I need a job. What is this? I'm here on earth. I'm walking around. Like, there must be something I'm supposed to do. I want a job in 24 hours. Next day, I got a call from a friend of mine named David Silver, who is a common, then as now, my best friend, and who's done many, many podcasts for Be Here Now and had one with Ragu for years. And he says, you'll never believe this, because David was struggling with his own professional situation. He couldn't get me a job. He was just hanging on for dear life himself. He says, you'll never believe this, but this guy at Channel 13 that I work with wants to meet you. He read some article you wrote. So I meet this guy, and he wanted me to do a thing on, they were doing a foundation proposal for experimental video, and could I oversee the editing of it and write the proposal? I'd never written the proposal. I'd never been involved with editing a video, but it was $200 a week for 3 weeks. I said, great, I'll do it. So I do 3 weeks worth of this. And then, it's up and finished. And I go to another one of these Hilda meetings and I walk and I said, God, I meant a full-time job. 3 weeks was great. Thank you. But now what do I do? 24 hours. Next day, I get a call. It was a Friday. Her meetings were on Thursday night. And there was a secretary at the PR firm of Salters and Roskin, an old school PR firm, where I'd interviewed months earlier. Gloria, the woman who introduced me to Ram Dass, had called the guy and said this could be a good guy, and they were looking for a long-haired rock type. And I didn't hear anything. I figured I didn't get the job. She says, I'm so embarrassed. I was supposed to call you, and I couldn't find your number till now. Can you start work on Monday? And wow. I've worked ever since. So I really have come to believe, is that karma? I would call it grace.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the difference between karma and grace. I don't want to
You're willing. But there's an element
but
of
I'll
you're willing
you thing,
to go and ask.
It's a true story,
yeah.
And I recommend it to anybody. I can't promise that the results will be quite as dramatic, but they might be. That's been my experience, is to honor when a lot of the things are mysterious. On the other hand, better not to be a jerk, better not to lose your temper, better to show up on time, better to be ethical. You do all those things.
Right.
But I think it's just a good idea, and it makes me feel better not to be a jerk if I can remember not to be one. But at the end of the day, a lot of it is just a complete mystery.
Well, and that is something that is coming full circle with the song that we listened to. I feel like that's what we're sitting in that mystery.
Yeah, you've got a friend in Jesus. That's what he's saying. You've got a friend in Jesus.
Yeah. And you, but know. The whole thing, the way that it's set up, the whole way that it plays, the whole space and ambiance around it is sitting in that mystery. And then there's the language is guiding you to the friend.
And she says, meditate on him. I just never thought of Aretha Franklin even using the word meditate.
I know.
It just, whoa.
Meditate
I'm
on
thinking
him.
That was all us hippies. They're meditating too.
Meditate on him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's right in the, she inserted that right into the lyric.
Yeah. And if when she said, the way she said it though too, it also made me feel that it was romantic. It made me feel like it was a romantic expression.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
it's delightful. Thank you for turning me on to it. And just tell us briefly, what's going on? You've got your book coming out. When's it coming out?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Serving the Servant, Remembering Kurt Cobain. The publication date is April 2nd, so my guess is it will have come out by the time somebody hears this. So it came out on April 2nd, and you know, I loved Kurt, and I worked with him for several years. It's a memoir about those 3.5 years of his life between the time I met him about 8 or 9 months before the big Nirvana album Nevermind came out and his death. And I did the best I could to reconstruct our relationship and what was going on then, and spoke to about 40 people that I worked with during that time, and went through my old notes and reread hundreds of interviews he did, and did my best to paint a little different picture of him. You know, so much of the public perception of him has become about his death that was so horrible, and he did have a heroin problem, and he was prone to depression, but he was not that's only a piece of who he was. He was also a loving, beautiful guy who was one of the great geniuses that rock and roll ever produced, and who was extremely responsible with how he used his success in terms of supporting other artists and standing up for women's rights and gay and lesbian rights, and setting an example of not being a jerk as a man, you know, kind of redefining what it was to be a man in a rock world that was otherwise toxically macho. And you know, I just loved him. So it was 25 years since his passing. It seemed like the right time to do the book, and that's my latest book.
What's the title?
It's called Serving the Servant, yeah. Remembering Kurt Cobain. And the title is a play on words. The last Nirvana studio album was called In Utero, and the first song was called Serve the Servants, plural. It's one of my favorite songs of his also. So I called it Serving the Servant, on the idea that he was kind of the servant of a muse that only he could understand, but which he could somehow transmute to millions of fans, and my job was to try to help him wherever I could, which was not always that much, but I did the best I could, and I loved him.
Oh, I look forward to reading it. I'm really excited to read it, and I think people will be happy to have it, and the timing is great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Danny, for the time. It's been so much fun. I'm so, so looking forward to watching this film and reading your book.
Thank you.